because we've seen, there's evidence that's shown, there's a whole movement of multicultural education. When youth are studying themselves, it makes it easier for them to look at the world in a critical context. When youth see education that reflects who they are, then they're able to, you know, get that A in biology or chemistry. So all I'm saying is really for us to take an approach in which Africanisms, African Americanisms, were at the forefront of that, and figure out how do we develop a subculture of economic and social empowerment which spreads throughout the community.
Welcome to World Beat. I am George Collins. Hope all you good folks out there are doing well, wherever and whenever you're tuning in. Now, a new generation of Black American activism has emerged in the last 10 years as movements like Black Lives Matter really broke into the public discourse. And these causes have brought wider attention to such issues of police corruption, discrimination, and housing. That's the real obvious one that we see on the surface. But beyond the political realm, many Black Americans are also taking this time to dig into their history and are finding a new sense of pride in their heritage. And one area of growing enthusiasm is in reclaiming these spiritual practices from the continent. Now, some of these folks felt particularly driven to that community and the healing aspects of such beliefs as the COVID-19 pandemic threw the whole world into the damn meat grinder. But in a piece in 2020 for Vox, one of the people they highlighted was Portia Little, a Brooklyn-based artist, diviner, and aberisha, who said that she received a huge increase in requests for divinations and readings as the pandemic has continued. And in that same piece, they also talked to assistant professor of Africana Studies at Rutgers University, Akisi Britton. And she said that, quote, with the pandemic and the anxiety and the fear and all these emotions that all of us are dealing with right now, in the beginning, my spiritual practice helped keep me connected and grounded and helped me understand this moment in the larger context, unquote. And keep in mind, that woman has been in the game as a Lukumi priestess for 37 years, they said. So beyond the personal fulfillment of these explorations, I'm also interested, could embracing African spiritual practices hold value in the liberation struggles of Black Americans? And how does this rise in enthusiasm for these beliefs intersect with the explosion of anti-racist activism in Black communities of the past decade? I'm really fascinated by this topic, and man, we could not have a better person to hash them out with us here today, let me tell you. Joining me on World Beat is Javon Bird. Javon is an ethnomusicologist and the founder of the Hawk Foundation for Research and Education in African and African American Culture. And that's a nonprofit that contracts with school districts to provide African American studies training to teachers in the K through 12 range. He's also the owner of Awodi Drummond LLC, which provides African music education for incarcerated youth. Javon, thanks so much for coming on World Beat today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, George. I think, you know, we've done a few interviews in the past. I'm excited to see, like, you know, the information that we'll both get out of this and, you know, also give my contributions.
Man, no doubt. Yeah, folks who have followed me for a while might recognize Javon. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him many times for a lot of different mediums, and I'm really excited for this, that we'll get to go a bit deeper on these topics here. Before we get into that, though, I do want to get a bit of background on you. I always like doing this, and would really like to know, I mean, where does the story start for Javon Bird?
Definitely. So, you know, I was born in Virginia, but raised out here in Seattle, Washington. I grew up in a household where music was a huge thing. So then, you know, parent got into African dancing, and then I saw the drumming, and I was like, hey, I definitely want to get into this, right? So continued on with that. I played saxophone and for the Garfield High School Band. You know, that's a pretty famous band out here in Washington. And I also went to school undergrad at the Evergreen State College, focusing primarily on ethnomusicology and traveling back and forth to Nigeria. First trip I was there, I stayed there for about 3 months. I was also initiated into their traditional practice. As you mentioned before, you know, the practice from the Yorubas that, you know, resonates around Orisha and various divination forms came to Cuba, and it's and was called Lukumi. You know, I'm there in Trinidad, you know, Shango Baptist, You know, even some of the voodoo practices of Haiti were significantly impacted by the Yoruba practices from the region. Now it's called Badagry, but then they called a lot of those people Nago, you know, Egun, right? And so those were that was kind of the clan of Yorubas that ended up going to Haiti and also really impacting a lot of their practice. So traditionally in Yoruba land, though, they call the practice Isheshe. And Isheshe represent is just basically the indigenous practice, the practice of the culture, right? And within that, there's branches. There's Ifa, which is under the deity of Orumiga. It's the system that he utilizes in order to divine and solve people's problems, and worshippers of Ifa also use that system. Then there's various other Orishas, and they have their own individualized practices, which are all connected loosely, of course, but then there's also very specific ways of practice depending on what Orisha you worship. So, and you know, so then you know, there's those practices, and then even the drum society is watched over by an Orisha, the drum called Ayum, and in Cuba they call Anya, right? And so that Orisha is the Orisha of music and drumming, and they drum in order to call the Orisha. They drum for various community celebrations and all that. So you have that going on. I was initiated to Ifa. I was also initiated to Obatala, and also Ayum, the spirit of the drum. So I do a lot of drumming, and you know, that's definitely led me to do a lot of to develop a nonprofit that's foundation is based upon research and education in African culture, right? So understanding various components of African culture, of Africanisms, of just basically development and figuring out, you know, how to develop systems here within the United States to help with African American social, economic, and intellectual development, right? So that's a part of that. I'm already drumming also, but basically all my businesses that I have are all rooted in culture, culture and information. And so I suppose, you know, that was a huge passion of mine. I said I wanted to, if I had to work 20 hours a day, what would it be? I've said, hey, it would be for something that I love. And that's, of course, culture. So that's kind of, that's my foundation, and that's who I am.
And when, I know you've talked in past interviews about the drum holding a lot of significance for you, especially early in life. Like, when did you really gain a sense of not just your passion for culture, but for African culture in particular? When did that really come up?
I suppose that came up, you know, when I got into African drumming, and I wanted to know, you know, I had a very inquisitive mind. I was like, okay, cool. So I know that originally African Americans came here from Africa. So what are the similarities? You know, I would hear it in a drumming, certain similarities in the polyrhythms to the music that's played popularly across America. And, you know, that was birthed, of course, in the African American community. And that made me think, okay, so there's still a connection here. So what else, you know, what other connections can I find? What are things that I can learn? What are things that were intended? And, you know, as I got in African-American culture, too, you know, studying, you recognize that, oh, it was intentional that they took away drums. It was intentional that they took away language. It was intentional that they took away food. So, you know, anything that an oppressor tries to take away from you, you definitely, I think it's worth looking into.
It's like that whole what do they call that? The Streisand effect, right? Like the more someone tries to stamp something out, and then it just ends up bringing even more spotlight on it. It's one of the greatest ironies out there. Exactly. And what did your parents do?
My mom, you know, got into the practice too. She was an educator. Then my dad, he's a whole like pastor. So you know, he's very religious, but you know, it's very, different. They're not together anymore. So, you know, definitely had a different influence on both sides. And I suppose on the religious side of my father, that probably as much as like, it might be like a weird dynamic to think about, or, you know, maybe ironic to think that, like, actually maybe him being so involved in Christianity helps me with actually being really committed to Ifa. Because it was kind of like, you know, seeing like a religious commitment early on probably, you know, had some sort of effect on me to say, oh, okay, well, when I do inner practice or spiritual practice, I should definitely have a level of discipline in it.
What are the politics like at home and the discussions of social issues? Like, what kind of environment was that like?
Because it was two different households, it was kind of like, okay, when I'm here with him, it's like, you know, I'm hearing what he said, you know, I kind of already knew what I was going to do. And so by the time he really got deeper into it, I was already a teen. So it's kind of like, okay, I'm, you know, listening, reading, studying and whatnot. And I think one of the things that I think confuses a lot of people about me is that I can read something and look at the bigger picture, meaning that even certain things in the Bible, that if someone's reading it to me, I say, oh, I agree with that. And I'll be like, oh, so do you want to be Christian? I'm like, no, well, you know, my practice, we believe in that too. But under this cultural concept, you know, concept or perspective or whatnot, or this epistemic framework. But, oh, okay, yeah. You know, so it kind of, I think sometimes a lot of people who are extremely binary, that confuses them. But, you know, for me, and I think that might be something I do get from studying in indigenous practice. There's no, like, a lot of times you'll see that there aren't clear binaries. It's more based on circumstance and situation.
And you, when do you start to get more of the spiritual inclination? You know, you mentioned that you are initiated into the, is it the Orisha faith? Is that what you would call it? Or what's the proper term for that?
Initiation.
Yeah, and so did you, when did you start to have an interest in that, that aspect of it?
I had an interest in that right away, like with the drumming, because I felt something in the drumming. And I remember I went to a Lukumi ceremony and I saw the Bata drums. I was like, oh, I love these drums. I want to learn how to drum them. So it was like, it was honestly like the religion was tied into my drumming. Actually, a lot of the secular drumming that I do is specifically for schools. But the music that I love actually is not secular. It's very religious music.
Mm-hmm. And when you're, I always love asking this of musicians, you know, when I've talked to them, like when you are drumming, what is it exactly that you do, like in your head? What I mean by that is like, there is the musical aspect as well. But when you're engaged in that process of creating sound, creating music, whatever that might be, what is your perception of what that process actually is, if that makes sense?
It does. It really depends. So if I'm drumming in a religious setting, my perception is more, okay, we have to drum. Each rhythm in the Yoruba like tradition or Bata tradition has a very specific relationship with a different Orisha. So if I'm drumming for Shango, right, I'm saying, okay, cool, I have to drum this pattern or drum this speech in order to call Shango down. If I'm drumming for Ifa, same thing. If I'm drumming for Oshun, Yemuja, Ogun, all the Orisha have their own very specific messages that I need to give out. So that's kind of what I do with my Orisha, with Orisha drumming, or with drumming in general. Like, it's almost like, how I put it, I'm drumming, but I'm speaking, or almost setting a stage for them to come and reveal themselves, you know? And so, like, if I'm drumming for people, though, it's more like, okay, I'm drumming, because drumming is very, you know, this music is very, how to put this music, you know, there's performative music, but then there's also collaborative music. So this music is very collaborative. Like, we openly invite, or participatory, that's what I meant. We openly invite people to come dance, to be a part of the movement, right? So then that's what's happening in my mind. I'm like, okay, how do I set the stage for people to also be open to dancing and having a good time?
Mm-hmm. And I'm also wondering, I know you've talked about that you have these dual influences on the one hand of your mother, who's also involved in these, on the other hand, your father, who's real deep in the church. And while you yourself have pointed out that things are not necessarily binary, especially when it does come to the spiritual lines, there are definitely a lot of people who may have felt that influence of the church and may have driven them away from such practices as this. What was it in your case that where you avoided that when so many others were not able to, or maybe felt compelled to reject any sense of digging into this heritage?
I think because at the root, so Christianity and heavy Christianity came later versus earlier. in my life, like with my father. So it wasn't until like, you know, I could really, even though he came from a Christian background, he wasn't particularly religious until I got around 10. And by that time, 10, 11, 12, right? And that's around the time when, you know, we started getting heavier into Ifa and Orisha. So because, you know, because I didn't have that background of looking at religions that were not Christian as being bad or evil or sinful, I think I was able to look at Christianity in a very balanced view by the time it did start trying to hit on me. You know, by the time my dad was like, hey, I want you all to be Christian or I want you to go to church. I was like, okay, well, I got to see what this is about. And so, you know, reading it, and I was very much, you know, very much a reader, very much a questioner and a thinker. So I couldn't get away from the fact that, hey, yes, there might be some things in this that aren't completely, you know, non-appealing. However, I can't get over the fact that they forced my ancestors to do this. And then, you know, and that this is actually, you know, a byproduct of warfare. And I think even like looking at things, I think a lot of cultures, that's a thing too. Colonization, right? I know, George, you like to do, you know, you do some fighting, you know, some training and whatnot, right? So, you know.
On the side, yeah.
Right, on the side, right? So let's look at it from a perspective of warfare, right? Colonization indoctrinates people, has a way of indoctrinating people into things, but also taking out or diffusing the element of them, which is really about self-determination. So for instance, when you got colonized people saying, oh, Christian God, Christian Jesus, and they had their own indigenous faiths, what that's a byproduct of is a group of people who, one, conquered you, then they indoctrinated you into their beliefs. And so there was a choice that was made of saying, okay, either we submit or, you know, we become or we indoctrinate ourselves into this system or we fight against this. And there's various forms of, you know, there's definitely various forms of resistance. I'm not saying that, like, even especially during the slave, you know, during pre-Civil War United States, you know, not everybody who converted into Christianity did it out of submission. Some of them said, okay, we're going to hide some of our Africanisms in this faith. You know, so that's why you hear a lot of even gospel music, right? That's, you know, that's a tradition that, you know, definitely comes from the Black American community that definitely also relies on a lot of our, you know, a lot of our, even, you know, when we think about pentatonic scales or even when we think about singing styles that might have come from Mali and various parts of Africa and infuse it within also, you know, within some of the European styles that we have here and also develop something completely new based upon the new experience. Because, you know, while slavery has happened all across the world, slavery of that kind that specifically said, hey, this group of people and you can't work your way out of this and this is chattel slavery, like that was a little bit different than other areas, right? So I believe that music also, you know, that music is a product of that. But I would also say that it still holds true to the fact that, you know, when you give up your own faith for another culture's faith, or another culture's way of viewing the world, then you lose something else. And so for me, I understood that clearly. And I said, hey, well, my ancestors, you know, I've only been in this country, my people have only been in this country for a few hundred years, but they've been in Africa for tens of thousands of years. I think I'm going to go with that legacy.
that means something, right? Track record's important.
Right, exactly.
And so did your father have any particular reactions to your practicing of Ifa or anything like that? What was that dynamic like?
It's a weird dynamic where, you know, I think a lot of Christians do things that they don't understand is very colonial. For instance, when they say stuff like, hey, let's all pray. Mm-hmm. Now, something that simple, something that nice is packed with a lot of colonial inclination, you know, or assumption. Meaning that, okay, let's all pray. Meaning that, okay, so we all pray the way that you pray. Let's all bow our heads. Oh, so we need to bow our heads to your God. You understand? And so, you know, I think if, unless you've really done the work, you might not see how colonial that is. But, you know, I've done a lot, you know, and so it's a little dynamic like that of being like, hey, well, I'm not going to be doing this or that. You know, that definitely causes some friction. But I think one of the things, especially, you know, I'm Adele, I have some accomplishments, which he is proud of and whatnot, right? So you kind of get that, okay, well, I'm going to respect you as a man. So this is what you do in your household, and this is what I'm going to do in my household. And we're cool on that. So I think that's kind of been a thing. Definitely being strong in who you are and why, and being able to articulate yourself too when people ask you the why is very important.
Now, you've also taken a number of trips to back to the continent. I know you've spent quite a bit of time in Nigeria in particular. What was that experience like when you first did it, and how was it received, you coming over from across the Atlantic and really being serious about this faith? What kind of reception did you get?
I've gotten respect. I've also gotten you know, so in Nigeria, too, because colonialism has happened here and there. So you get some people who are just shocked at the fact that you even want to study this. And they're like, and they're asking you why. Some people are feel as if this is the only thing that they might have had after colonization, which is not the case. But still, some people feel that way. So then they feel overprotective about it. Some actually, I've had people look at me and be like, oh, wow, well, you look like one of us. I think I heard about people being taken a long time ago. And, you know, I've been called Omobowale by some, which is our child's come back home. So I've had definitely mixed responses. I'm not going to tell African-Americans who might be listening to this that you're going to go to home to Africa and everybody's going to love you and accept you. Like, you know, like at the end of roots. And they're like, oh, my God, you're us. No, that's not the case. Humans are humans. So you're going to have very mixed reactions. But I think for me, one of the things that's helped me is just knowing the facts. Like, knowing that, hey, my ancestors were taken from here, so whether, you know, I'm accepted or not does not tarnish that fact that I belong here. Mm-hmm.
And stateside, what kind of responses do you get to this sort of thing?
You know, I get a lot of different responses. So a lot of people do like it. Some people are just shocked, you know, especially Washington, the Black American community here is very Christian. So what you get is a lot of people who are like, okay, but is he a devil worshiper? You know, in the back of their minds, they're thinking that too. But then some, like, you know, especially amongst the more Afrocentric community, they're like, okay, we know what he's doing. Now, we might not necessarily do it, but okay, cool. He's following the pathway of his ancestors. We can't say nothing.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of, I don't know if you know about Jabari Osaze over there in Harlem, but he runs a longtime Kemetic temple over there, right? And a lot of Black folks get into that. But I've heard him talk sometimes where he'll say, like, yeah, sometimes I'll be sitting around and people ask me, are you spiritually inclined? And he'll have to say, well, I'm not really Christian. And they'll say, like, oh, okay, so Muslim, right? And he's like, not quite. He jokes about that that quite a bit. What would you say has been the impact, not just on you personally, but in your outlook, your drive? What benefits do you think that a lot of really digging into this practice and understanding the history, what do you feel like that's really brought you?
It's definitely brought me a sense of structure, order, discipline, and something to work towards. So, you know, in Yoruba culture, you're not only just working for yourself. It's not individualistic at all. You're working for your future generations. So it's definitely gotten me to, you know, that's why I do business. That's why I'm into contracting, into studying. Like, I'm reading real estate investing, you know, all that stuff. It just gets you focused on saying, oh, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this to continue my legacy, to continue, to build a foundation for my family. So it gives you a structure in which you're like, you know, because, you know, humans on our own, it's like, okay, cool. But we are social creatures, and we do need structure. We need society. We need to be celebrated when we do certain things. So this tradition has helped me to really focus and not only think about who I am, but focus on what are the consequences of my actions. Mm-hmm. And how are they going to affect people after me?
No doubt. No doubt. I don't think you can get much better a foundation than that, if you ask me, with that kind of logic. Now, I really want to dig deeper into some of the wider history of a lot of these practices, because as you've definitely taught me from some of your other lectures, there's quite a bit of significance, not just in the history, but in some implications for today. And that's what we're going to start digging into our next segment. So stick with us. We'll be right back with Javon Bird here on World Beat. Welcome back to World Beat. I'm George Collins. We are sitting here with Javon Bird. And Javon, there's a long history of these practices, these traditional practices, whatever folks want to use, whatever term, here on the American continents, especially, as you've noted in the first segment, in connection with slavery. You've taught many seminars on the role of these practices in Black resistance, starting all the way from when the first slave sets foot on the continents here. And I find it interesting because I'm not just talking about the American United States context, but I'm actually reading right now, it's called Brazil, a biography. Mm-hmm. And as I don't need to tell you, but listeners might know, Brazil is very, I find so many similarities between the US and Brazil in a lot of different ways, but certainly in terms of the legacy of slavery and the impacts it's still having. So there's a lot of implications for that nation as well. But talk about what is the history of these practices being used in the Americas, and in particular with slave resistance?
So in the Americas in general, you know, Haiti was definitely, when we think about Haiti, we think about the impact that voodoo had, to the point where the United States had an effort through one of their first media efforts, actually, to suppress Africanisms in the United States. So, I mean, of course, there was already an effort there in general, but after what happened in Haiti, you know, you started seeing like a portrayal of just like, oh, hey, voodoo's evil, voodoo's bad, until, you know, in the 1900s, when we did have actual movies and videotapes and whatnot, and you start seeing like, hey, you know, the voodoo dolls, oh, this person will do something bad to you and whatnot. And, you know, when you look at voodoo, because there's a concept in Yoruba practice called Odu, which are basically representations of the Orunmore, which are like heavenly figures or guides or whatnot, right? And so within the Odu Ifa, and there's about 256 in the Ifa, there's about 16 in Aaron, about 17 in Arundel-Ogun. And these Odu speak about, you know, honestly speak about like the secrets of life, right? So then when we think about Odu, then think about the word voodoo, right? Voodoo and whatnot like that. You know, it's a practice that of studying God, basically, of understanding herbs, of understanding healing, of understanding drumming, of understanding how to work in harmony with each other in order to stay in alignment with ourselves and stay in alignment with nature. So you have this practice that gets turned into, you know, that gets a horrible media rap for being about evil or hurting other people. And it's really disheartening that this continues on, even in the African-American community. We have people saying, hey, you know, that voodoo, hey, be careful about that. Without understanding that the real reason why you look at it in that negative route is because Africans were able to use voodoo to overcome the white enslavers, or to overcome, you know, European nations or whatnot like that, France. So then, you know, you got the same concept in Haiti. You know, they have very, and they have characters that, that are still intertwined with Orisha. Like you got the martial art hero Besoro. You got, Ganga Zumbi and Ganga Zumba, you know, the, who were also great, freedom fighters who are also into African spirituality. And you see how spirituality, African spirituality across the Caribbean also led to a lot of fighting. I mean, what I mean by fighting is revolting against these systems. Because, you know, if you're, remember at that time, Africans were banned from reading. So if you're getting told that, hey, you know, be a slave should be good to their master, or you're getting told that, okay, hey, you know, the position that you're in is actually ordained by God. That's very different than if you're connected to a spirituality where your ancestors told you, oh, you know, you can be free, or you have a connection to another reality, right? So I think that's why also here in the United States, African culture is, or African spirituality is starting to grow, because people are starting to say, hey, I don't have to do this. I can do it this way instead.
And so what does some of this resistance look like in practice at this time? I know you've told stories about folks who are able to like meet in the swamp, right? Because they're confident that the animals ain't going to get them while they're down there. What are some of the organizing tactics in places like Haiti that revolved around these practices?
You know, divination to let you know about certain things, like to let you know, okay, is this the right time? You know, they used nature to figure out if it was the right time for them to fight back. Ways of healing yourself. You know, there were herbs and medicines that people were able to, utilize through their practice, and even get told by, you know, using certain spiritual medicines to figure out the herbs on their land at that area, right? So that's important. The music. Drums in general can actually speak the language, various African languages. So the Yoruba culture, they have, it's a very tonal language, almost like three tones, do, re, mi, right? And so the drummers actually utilize that and they play. And so when they're playing, you know, when the drummers are playing, they're able to also speak to Orisha, but they can also speak to each other. So that was also in the Jimmy Cato rebellion in 1739 in South Carolina. That's exactly what they used. They used the ability to be able to hear the drums, speak to each other, to actually know when it was time for them to fight against their slave masters. So there's a plethora of different uses that African spirituality or African indigenous thought had on the benefits that they had for African people and their resilience and their fight to be free.
And so it seems to me like this suppression of these practices, the impetus comes from a number of different fronts. On the one hand, it is the fact that this is, in a practical sense, being used as an organizing wedge, as a way to get people to fight back. There is also the constant stigma associated with anything coming from the continent at this time, both from a political aspect and a spiritual aspect. And it seems like both in the presence of these practices as a resistance tool and also the counterforces to them really seems like a dichotomy that hasn't really gone away. Like, what are some of the effects of that are still felt today, even all these centuries later?
I think that, I would say that here's the thing. Within the American complex, we also have subcultures and also the subgroups who've been affected by it in different ways. So I think that while in American, like especially like in the dominant culture, right, that which is associated with old is something that they're moving away from, right? Because even on an oppressive level, you know, a lot of white folks don't even like the idea of thinking, damn, did our ancestors really just kill all these indigenous people and enslave all these African people? No, we're not trying to be down with that. So let's get away from this old stuff and let's go to a new like type of world, right? Or new modernism. But a lot of African Americans, actually, I think the opposite is happening. Because for us, it wasn't necessarily our past which was as vulgar as or as harsh or oppressive as what we're facing now. So I think there's a lot of people who are actually trying to reach back in order to understand what a society looked like with African or Black autonomy, right? And figure out, okay, how can we take from that past and build or carve ourselves out a new future? So I think that's kind of what I've seen in a lot, but not in a lot of the African-American community. I will say that there's still a huge segment that are very, a segment of people who are very much so tied to, okay. And I think a lot of those are the people who just don't think anyway, you know, who are kind of tied into saying, hey, you know, yeah, but I'm Christian because that's just what everybody does. And maybe have never asked themselves, okay, well, what did African people do beforehand? So there's that group, but then there's another group that's actually asking themselves those hard questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually a great segue into something else I was thinking about, which is we've already talked about this stigma against these mm-hmm. practices in particular. And I think the impulse for a lot of folks might be to say, well, it's because of the Black church, which might be true in certain parts of the country. But as you pointed out, like there's a lot of different cultures that go on here. And like a Black church in Brooklyn ain't the same as a Black church in Atlanta, right? Which ain't the same as a Black church out here in Seattle.
Right, right.
So it seems to me like they're, and you also pointed out too, that there is not just a current intersection of different faiths, but even historically, like the fact that, in the case of Haitian Catholicism, a lot of those figures are incorporated as the saints, sometimes more for practical reasons of disguises. Again, down in Brazil, it's the same thing, that a lot of it was the same tactic. But then I also wonder, too, about something that was brought up in another podcast I was listening to about the whole idea of like Afrofuturism and like why is that such a big thing? And one of the points that was made was that if you take a look at when American citizens are surveyed about like the state of the country, and generally speaking, white folks tend to be more optimistic about it than Black folks. And the reasons for that actually, I think, are really fascinating, because what white people will do is compare how things are now to how they were in the past. Whereas a lot of times Black respondents will compare things how they are now to how they potentially could be, and that there is more of a forward thinking thing. And that's where this impulse for Afrofuturism comes from. I wonder, you know, and you've just made some allusions to it here too, the whole idea of not wanting to turn to the past because things were so horrible, right? I guess I'm saying all this to set up, like, where does this stigma come from exactly? That as there, even amidst a rising tide of people wanting to dig into their heritage and really claiming Black identity with a certain amount of pride and gratitude, there still seems to be that the spiritual element for those that are inclined is still really taboo in a lot of ways. What do you think really drives that impulse?
Fear, of course. If you've been indoctrinated with the idea that if you don't worship Jesus, or you don't worship God in the way that the Bible tells you to, that you'll go to hell, eternity, that'll make a lot of people say, hey, even though logically I understand, I've been conditioned to think this way, and I'm afraid to go against that. You know, a lot of people who come from Christian backgrounds who do adopt African spirituality, I'd say that they're even more courageous than I am, because I never really believed in the Christian concept of heaven and hell. I didn't grow up with that indoctrination. So someone who was indoctrinated by that and then decides to go against that, that's definitely going to be, you know, a psychological just milestone for them to even be able to make that leap. And so, you know, me personally, I've never had to make that leap, so I don't really understand, but I've seen people who were Christian, when they finally, that moment when they finally let go of Jesus, they start crying. And I'm like, and I was going, well, why are you crying? And I'm like, because I know I got to let go of Jesus. And you know, I don't really understand fully. I've just been able to just empathize, but I can definitely imagine that that's intense.
because that indoctrination, you know, the African community, American community, what we did was all of our deep levels of spirituality, praise, our desire to praise, we put it into the church. And so that's where actually a lot of most Africanisms, if you want to find most Africanisms in the African-American community, you go to the church, to a real black church, you know, and then you'll find, and you'll see the Africanisms, you know, any ethnographic research who wants to really study black Americans, like black Americans in their most African form, should go to the church, mm-hmm. you know, for that research, right? And so to rip yourself off, it's almost like, I'd hate to say it this way. I know I'm gonna have some people probably look at me in the podcast and say, how dare you? It's almost like someone who's an addict of something. Yes, I said an addict. Like, you know, you got to, you're reliant on some sort of drug or even alcohol to give you a feeling that you're kind of missing out on or whatnot. And then, oh gosh, this is harsh. And then you being told that, hey, you know, I understand why you're doing this, but the better way of getting that feeling is actually through this. Maybe you're doing it because you don't do music anymore. So maybe you should do that music, or you should do this, or things that actually make you happy, right? It still takes a lot for you to get off of that, right? Even though it was really just, I don't want to say pretend, but it was just like a way for you to feel, even if it wasn't the exact feeling, to feel something similar to what you were looking for. But sometimes peeling yourself off of that to actually engage yourself in what you were looking at can be hard.
Well, and that makes me think about how, as we are talking about confronting the slave legacy in a really transparent way that ain't really been done before in the history of the what's now the United States, and especially with things like the 1619 Project from a couple of years ago, if you remember that. And yet, as you pointed out and some other scholars have pointed out, there's a real marriage between the spread of Christianity in black communities and the legacy of colonialism. And yep. Not always, but like you said, some folks, it was a matter of like adapt or die, quite literally.
Right.
But that, to me, it would seem like would be a much more difficult thing to really drill down into, because yeah. It's one thing to examine the slavery legacy when one's detached from it, not detached as in, I guess I shouldn't use that word, because that's often used as like, I had nothing to do with it. But I mean, like, when it's not something that you show up for every Sunday, you know, like it's not as right. deeply ingrained with it. Whereas when you're asking people to confront the foundations of black Christianity in the United States, that starts treading on some hallowed ground for a lot of folks. I mean, that gets real dicey.
Yeah, it definitely gets dicey. And I think that's, you know, that's just that journey that some people are going to make and some aren't.
Well, and it also strikes me that we are talking about the United States, but this is also true in, you know, we've mentioned Brazil, even though on the continent, I mean, I know you've talked about some of the
definitely on the continent. Like, there's only like about, I think they say like 10%, maybe a little bit less than that, of the Nigerian population that actually openly practices their traditional religion.
And even there, that, as I understand it, so much of that seems to be concentrated in Yoruba, as opposed to you know, the Christianization of the Igbos, the Hausa, of course, a very devout Muslim.
Yo, the Igbos, you know, I was just watching a documentary on it, and I've seen it with my own eyes. Like, they'll straight up say, "Nah, Igbos, if you want, it's far and few in between that you'll find an Igbo traditional practitioner." The Yorubas, and also, this is jacked up, but I'm not jacked up, but this is an unfortunate truth. Socially, I mean, let's just say by our standards of today, I'm not going to say they were or not, right? But many anthropologists have noted that Yoruba society was more developed than Igbo society as far as social and structurally. So that's why a lot of the Igbos did actually jump on Christianity, because it gave them a certain social power above other Nigerian or quote-unquote Nigerian tribes at that time, you know, with the Christianity. So you see that legacy within Igbos to this day. Nigerian. And interestingly enough, they have a system of Ifa. They call it Afa. But they divine using the same divination tools that Yorubas divine with as well.
Well, and it's certainly known that I know it's a stereotype that Igbos tend to be real go-getters, real gunners, right? And it ain't an accident that you look at Nigeria's business elite, and it pretty much is entirely Igbos in a lot of ways. And yeah, so it would make sense that the whole idea of using Christianity to further goals like that, and I don't mean this to like in a nefarious way, but it's just it goes hand in hand with that philosophy.
And here's the most fascinating thing about that Igbo legacy, though, right? While they were the first, like, while they were some of the strongest and, like, most open to Christianity, that was only in Africa. In the Americas, though, Igbos were actually some of the one of the most feared groups because their traditions a lot of times forbid them to bow to any god except their own traditional one. So you had Igbo, that's why you have Igbo landing here off of the coast of Georgia, where the Igbos looked on the Americas and they said no, and they all went into that water and drowned themselves, walked into that because they'd rather die than be someone's slave. You know, they got a whole Igbo dance in Haiti, for voodoo. It's a whole rhythm and whatnot. And that's like one of the most powerful dances of the Igbos literally ripping their chains off and stuff, right? You have in Virginia, as I mentioned, the Dismal Swamps and everything. At one point, the majority of the slaves that were brought to Virginia were coming straight from, the Bight of Biafra. So they're coming straight from, so there, you have a huge Igbo Nigerian populace there. You know, it's interesting to say, like, even when we think about Ifa or Afa, a lot of African-Americans who are attracted to Yoruba Ifa probably are descended from Igbo Afa people. You know, and when you look at that from that, like, you know, when you look at it from that anthropological view, it's just really fascinating. It's really fascinating to see how on the continent, yes, there was this going on, but those who were taken were actually very fierce defenders of their African identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing over on the eastern part of the continent too. You know, I've spent time in Kenya and talked to a lot of folks from that region over there. And there's a very similar dynamic where there are certain tribal groups that are highly associated with those more, I don't know if traditional is the word I should use. I kind of hate that word in a lot of ways because it seems really loaded.
Yeah.
We'll just say the indigenous practices over there. You know, and I think about like in Kenya, you got one of the groups is the Kamba, right? And if you start digging into like Kamba stereotypes like that you get in media, especially for the women, right? It's all going to be, they're just a bunch of these crazy nymphos who are going to put these black magic curses on you if you them off or whatever. Yeah. And it is true that among Kambas and also down in neighboring Tanzania with some of the groups down there, there's a relatively high retention of those traditional ways, of those old ways like that. And this to me, I mean, this is it's heartbreaking in a lot of ways that it doesn't, even if you go back to the source and even if you go all around the world, this stigma still seems to exist. In fact, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on this. My impression is like the U.S. seems to be one of the places where it's actually gaining the most traction out of anywhere else. So.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. I've had a Nigerian priest tell me straight up, you guys in America, like you found more than a lot of us do out here. They said that to me. I said, ouch. I don't know how I feel about that, but okay. You know, to the point where they're like, yeah. You know, and it's really interesting to just look at it from that perspective and understand that, oh, okay, this is reality. Yeah. You know, well, so definitely, yeah.
Well, and certainly when you got public figures like Rihanna who, you know, gets ISIS tattooed across her chest, I mean, that's definitely a good sign. Mm-hmm. And now we've really done a lot of framing on kind of the history and where the stigma comes from. Next, I want to move to how we start breaking that and a lot of the work you've been doing in that respect. So that's where we're heading in our next segment. Stick with us on World Beat. We'll be right back.